You're a vampire, Wayne said. You're taking something out of me and putting it into you. Manx considered him briefly in the rearview mirror.
The car is making both of us better. It is like one of those vehicles they have now that they call hybrids. Do you know about hybrids? They run half on gasoline, half on good intentions. But this is the original hybrid. This car runs on gasoline and bad intentions. Thoughts and feelings are just another kind of energy. Same as oil. This vintage Rolls-Royce is getting fine mileage out of all your bad feelings and all the things that ever hurt and scared you. I am not speaking poetically. Do you have any scars?
Wayne said, I slipped with a putty knife, and it gave me a scar right here. He held up his right hand, but when he looked at it, he could not find the hairline scar that had always been on the ball of his thumb. It mystified him what could have happened to it.
The road to Christmasland removes all sorrows, eases all pain, and erases all scars. It takes away all the parts of you that weren't doing you any good, and what it leaves behind is made clean and pure. By the time we arrive at our destination, you will be innocent not only of pain, but also of the memory of pain. All your unhappiness is like grime on a window. When the car is done with you, it will be cleared away, and you will shine clear. And so will I.
Oh, Wayne said, what if I wasn't in the car with you? What if you went to Christmasland alone? Would the car still make you younger? Would it still make you shine?
My, you have a lot of questions. I bet you are a straight A student. No, I cannot get to Christmasland alone. I cannot find the road by myself. Without a passenger, the car is just a car. That is the best thing about it. I can be made happy and well only by making others happy and well. The healing road to Christmasland is just for the innocent. The car will not let me hog it all for myself. I have to do good for others if I want good to be done to me. If only the rest of the world worked that way.
Is this the healing road to Christmasland? Wayne asked, peering out the window. It looks more like I-80.
It is Interstate 80, now that you are awake. But just a minute ago, you were dreaming sweet dreams and we were on the St. Nick Parkway, under old Mr. Moon. Don't you remember? The snowmen and the mountains in the distance?
Wayne would not have been more jolted if they had hit a deep pothole. He did not like to think that Manx had been in his dream with him. He flashed back briefly to a memory of that deranged sky filled with static. Sky falsa is that. Wayne knew that Grandma Lindy was trying to tell him something, trying to give him a way to protect himself from what Manx and his car were doing to him. But he didn't understand her, and it seemed like it would be too much effort to figure it out. Besides, it was a little late for her to start giving him advice. She had not exactly strained herself to tell him anything of use when she was alive, and he suspected her of disliking his father just because Lou was fat.
When you drift off, we will find it again, Manx said. The sooner we get there, the sooner you can ride the sleigh coaster and play Stick the Blind with my daughters and their friends.
They were in a trench slicing through a forest of corn. Machines stood over the rows, black girders that arced in the sky like the proscenium above a stage. The thought occurred to Wayne that those machines were sprayers, full of poison. They would drench the corn in a lethal rain to keep it from being eaten by invasive species. Those exact words, invasive species, rang through his brain. Later the corn would be lightly washed and people would eat it. Does anyone ever leave Christmasland? Wayne asked.
Once you get there, you will not want to leave. Everything you could ever want will be right there. There are all the best games. There are all the best rides. There is more cotton candy than you could eat in 100 years.
But could I leave Christmasland if I wanted to? Manx gave him an almost hostile glance in the mirror.
Then again, maybe some teachers felt you were badgering them with all your questions. What were your grades like?
Not very good.
Well, you will be glad to know there is no school in Christmasland. I hated school myself. I would rather make history than read about it. They like to tell you that learning is an adventure, but that is a lot of hooey. Learning is learning. Adventure is adventure. I think once you know how to add and subtract and can read suitably well, anything else is likely to lead to big ideas and trouble.
Wayne took this to mean that he would not be able to leave Christmasland. Do I get some last requests?
Look here. You act like you have been sentenced to death. You are not on death row. You will arrive at Christmasland better than ever.
But if I'm not coming back, if I have to be in Christmasland forever, there are some things I want to do before I get there. Can I have a last meal?
What do you mean? Do you think you will not be fed in Christmasland?
What if there's food I want that I can't get there? Can you get whatever you want to eat in Christmasland?
There is cotton candy and cocoa and hot dogs and the candy on a stick that always hurts my teeth. There is everything a child could want.
I'd like an ear of corn. A buttered ear of corn, Wayne said. And a beer.
I am sure it would be no trouble to get you some corn and, what did you say? Root beer? There is good root beer out here in the Midwest. Even better is sarsaparilla.
Not root beer. A real beer. I want a Coors Silver Bullet.
Why would you want a beer?
My dad said I'd get to have one with him on the porch when I was 21. He said I could have one on the 4th of July and watch the fireworks. I was looking forward to it. I guess that isn't going to happen now. Also, you said it's Christmas every day in Christmasland. I guess that means no July 4th. They aren't very patriotic in Christmasland. I'd like some sparklers, too. I had sparklers in Boston. They went over a long, low bridge. The grooved metal hummed soulfully under the tires. Manx did not speak again until they reached the other side.
You are full of talk tonight. We have gone 1,000 miles, and this is the most I have heard out of you. Let's see if I have this right. You would like me to buy you a tall boy, an ear of sweet corn, and enough fireworks for your own private 4th of July. Are you sure there is not anything else you might want? Were you planning to have goose liver pate and caviar with your mother when you graduated from high school?
I don't want my own private 4th of July. I just want some sparklers and maybe a couple rockets. He paused, then said, You told me you owed me one. For killing my dog.
There followed a period of grim silence.
I did, Manx admitted at last. I had put that out of my mind. I am not proud of it. Would you consider a square if I got you a beer and an ear of corn and some fireworks?
No. But I won't ask for anything else.
He looked out the window and spied the moon. It was a chipped sliver of bone, faceless and remote. Not as good as the Christmasland moon. Everything was better in Christmasland, Wayne supposed.
How did you find out about Christmasland?
Manx said, I drove my daughters there, and my first wife.
He paused, then added,
My first wife was a difficult woman, hard to satisfy. Most redheads are. She had a long list of complaints that she held against me, and she made my own children mistrust me. We had 2 daughters. Her father gave me money to set me up in business, and I spent it on a car. This car. I thought Cassie, that was my first wife, would be happy when I came home with it. Instead, she was impertinent and difficult as always. She said I had wasted the money. I said I was going to be a chauffeur. She said I was going to be a pauper, and so were they. She was a scornful woman and abused me in front of the children, which is a thing no man should stand.
Manx flexed his hands on the wheel, his knuckles whitening.
Once my wife threw an oil lamp at my back and my best coat caught fire. Do you think she ever apologized? Well, think again. She would make fun of me at Thanksgiving and family get-togethers, pretending she was me and that she had just been set aflame. She would run around gobbling like a turkey and waving her arms, screaming, Put me out! Put me out! Her sisters always had a good laugh at that. Let me tell you something. The blood of a red-headed woman is 3 degrees cooler than the blood of a normal woman. This has been established by medical studies.
He gave Wayne a wry look in the rear view.
Of course, the very thing that makes them impossible to live with is what makes it hard for a man to stay away, if you catch my meaning.
Wayne didn't, but nodded anyway.
Manx said, Well, all right then. I think we have reached an understanding. I know a place where we can buy fireworks so loud and bright, you will be deaf and blind by the time we are done shooting them off. We should get to the Here library just after dark tomorrow. We can shoot them off there. By the time we are done launching rockets and throwing cherry bombs, people will think the Third World War is underway.
He paused, then added in a sly tone,
Perhaps Miss Margaret Lee will join us for the festivities. I wouldn't mind lighting a fuse under her, just to teach her a thing or two about minding her own beeswax.
Why does she matter? Wayne asked. Why don't we just leave her alone?
A large green moth hit the windshield with a soft, dry smack, made an emerald smear on the glass.
You are a clever young man, Wayne Carmody, Manx said. You read all the stories about her. I am sure if you put your mind to it, you will see why she is of concern to me.
Back when it was still light, Wayne had flicked through the collection of papers Manx had brought to the car, items Bing had found online that concerned Margaret Lee. There were a dozen stories in all, telling a single larger story about abandonment, addiction, loneliness, and odd, unsettling miracles. The first piece dated back to the early 90s and had run in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Psychic or lucky guesser, local librarian's wild hunch saves kids. It told the story of a man named Hayes Archer who lived in Sacramento. Archer had packed his two sons into his brand new Cessna and lifted off with them for a moonlight flight along the California coast. His plane wasn't the only thing that was new. So was his pilot's license. 40 minutes after heading out, Archer's single-engine Cessna made several erratic maneuvers, then disappeared from the radar. It was feared he had lost sight of land in a gathering fog and crashed into the sea while trying to find the horizon. The story got some play in the national news, Archer being worth a small fortune. Margaret Lee had called the police in California to tell them Archer and his children weren't dead, hadn't crashed into the sea. They had made land and gone down in a gorge. She couldn't give the exact location, but felt that the police should search the coast for some point at which it was possible to find salt. The Cessna was discovered 40 feet off the ground, upside down in a redwood tree in, wait for it, Salt Point State Park. The boys were unharmed. The father had a broken back, but was expected to survive. Maggie said her unlikely insight had come to her in a flash while playing Scrabble. The article ran alongside a photograph of the upside-down plane and another of Maggie herself, bent over a Scrabble board at a tournament. The caption below this second photo said, With her lucky hunches, it's too bad Maggie's game of choice is Scrabble and not the lottery. There had been other insights over the years. A child found in a well. Information about a man lost at sea while attempting to sail around the world. But they came less and less often, further and further apart. The last, a little article about Maggie helping to locate a runaway, had appeared in 2000. Then there was nothing until 2008, and the articles that followed were not about miracles, but something like the opposite. First there had been a flood in Here, Iowa, a lot of damage, a drowned library. Maggie had nearly drowned herself trying to rescue books and been treated for hypothermia. Fundraisers failed to collect enough money to keep the library open, and the place was shuttered. In 2009, Maggie had been charged with public endangerment for starting a fire in an abandoned building. She had drug paraphernalia in her possession at the time. In 2010, she had been arrested and charged with squatting and possession of heroin. In 2011, she was arrested for solicitation. Maybe Maggie Lee could predict the future, but her psychic gift had not warned her to stay clear of the undercover cop in the lobby of a Cedar Rapids motel. She got 30 days for it. Later that same year, she was picked up again, but this time her destination was the hospital, not jail. She was suffering from exposure. In that article, her plight was described as all too frequent among Iowa's homeless, which was how Wayne found out she was living on the street. You want to see her because she knew you were coming and she told my mom, Wayne said finally.
I need to see her because she knew I was on the road and wanted to make trouble for me, Manx said. And if I do not have words with her, I cannot be sure she will not make trouble for me again. This is not the first time I have had to deal with someone of her ilk. I try whenever possible to avoid people like her. They are always nettlesome.
People like her? You mean other librarians?
Max snorted.
You are being coy with me. I am glad to see you recovering your sense of humor. I mean to say there are other people besides me who can access the secret shared worlds of thought.
He reached up and tapped his temple to show where that world resided.
I have my wraith, and when I am behind the wheel of this car, I can find my way onto the secret roads that lead to Christmasland. I have known others who could use totems of their own to turn reality inside out, to reshape it like the soft clay it is. There was Craddock McDermott, who claimed that his spirit existed in a favorite suit of his. There is the walking backwards man, who has an awful watch that runs in reverse. You do not want to meet the walking backwards man in a dark alley, child, or anywhere else. There is the true knot, who live on the road and are much in the same line of work as myself. I leave them be, and they are glad to return the favor. And our Maggie Lee will have a totem of her own, which she uses to pry and spy. Probably these Scrabble tiles she mentions. Well, she seems to have taken quite an interest in me. I guess if we are driving by, it would only be polite to pay a visit. I would like to meet her and see if I can't cure her of her curiosity.
He shook his head and then laughed. That husky hoarse caw of his was an old man's laugh. The road to Christmasland could make his body young, but it couldn't do anything about the way he laughed. He drove. The dotted yellow line stammered past on the left. Finally, Manx sighed and went on.
I don't mind telling you, Wayne, almost all of the trouble I've ever known started with one woman or another. Margaret Lee and your mother and my first wife were all cut from the same cloth, and Lord knows there have been plenty more where they came from. Do you know what? All the happiest times in my life were times when I was free of the feminine influence, when I didn't have to make accommodations. Men spend most of their lives being passed from woman to woman and being pressed into service for them. You cannot imagine the life I have saved you from. Men cannot stop thinking about women. They get thinking about a lady, and it is like a hungry man thinking about a rare steak. When you are hungry and you smell a steak on the grill, you get distracted by that tight feeling in your throat, and you quit thinking. Women are aware of this. They take advantage of it. They set terms, same as your mother sets terms before you come to dinner. If you don't clean your room, change your shirt, and wash your hands, you aren't allowed to sit at the dinner table. Most men figure they are worth something if they can meet the terms a woman sets for them. It provides them with their whole sense of value. But when you take a woman out of the picture, a man can get a little quiet inside. When there's no one to bargain with except for yourself and other men, you can figure yourself out. That always feels good.
Why didn't you divorce your first wife? Wayne asked. If you didn't like her.
No one did back then. It never even crossed my mind. It crossed my mind to leave. I even did leave a time or two, but I came back.
Why?
I got hungry for steak.
Wayne asked, how long ago was it when you were first married?
Are you asking how old I am?
Yes. Manx smiled.
I will tell you this. On our first date, Cassie and I went to see a silent movie. It was that long ago.
What movie?
It was a horror picture from Germany, although the title cards were in English. During the scary parts, Cassie would hide her face against me. We attended the show with her father, and if he had not been there, I believe she would have crawled into my lap. She was only 16 at the time, just a nub of a thing, graceful and considerate and shy. This is the way with many women. In youth they are precious gems of possibility. They shudder with feverish life and desire. When they turn spiteful, it is like a chick molting, shedding the fuzz of youth for darker feathers. Women often give up their early tenderness as a child gives up his baby teeth.
Wayne nodded and thoughtfully tugged one of his upper teeth out of his mouth. He poked his tongue at the hole where it had been, the blood oozing in a warm trickle. He could feel a new tooth beginning to protrude where the old one had been, although it felt less like a tooth, more like a small fishing hook. He put the lost tooth in the pocket of his shorts with the others. He had lost 5 teeth in the 36 hours he had been in the Wraith. He wasn't worried about it. He could feel rows and rows of small new teeth coming in.
"Later, you know, my wife accused me of being a vampire, just like you," Max said. "She said I was like the fiend in that first movie we saw together, the German picture. She said I was draining the life out of our 2 daughters, feeding off them. But here it is, so many years later, and my daughters are still going strong, happy and young and full of fun. If I were trying to drain the life out of them, I guess I did a poor job of it. For a few years there, my wife made me so unhappy I was about ready to kill her and me and the children, too, just to be done with it. But now I can look back and laugh. Have a peek at my license plate sometime. I took my wife's horrid ideas about me and made a joke out of them. That is the way to survive. You have to learn to laugh, Wayne. You have to keep finding ways to have fun. Do you think you can remember that?"
"I think so," Wayne said.
"This is all right," Manx told him. "2 guys driving together at night. This is just fine. I don't mind saying you are better company than that Bing Partridge. At least you do not feel the need to make a foolish song out of everything."
In a shrill, piping voice, Manx sang,
"I love you. I love me. I love playing with my Winky Wee."
He shook his head.
"I have had a number of long trips with Bing, and each was longer than the last. You cannot imagine what a relief it is to be with someone who is not always singing foolish songs or asking foolish questions."
"Can we get something to eat soon?" Wayne asked. Manx slapped the wheel and laughed.
"I guess I spoke too quickly, because if that is not a foolish question, it is close to it, young Master Wayne. You were promised some sweet potato fries, and by God I mean for you to have them. I have brought over 100 children to Christmasland in the last century, and I have not starved one to death yet."
The diner of the fabled sweet potato fries was another 20 minutes west, an installation of chrome and glass set in a parking lot the size of a football field. Sodium vapor lights on 30-foot-high steel poles lit the blacktop as bright as day. The lot was crowded with 18-wheelers, and through the front windows Wayne could see that every stool along the bar was occupied, as if it were 12 noon and not 12 at night. The whole country was on the watch for an old man and a child in an antique Rolls-Royce Wraith, but not one person in the diner looked outside and took note of them, and Wayne was not surprised. He had by now accepted that the car could be seen, but not noticed. It was like a channel on TV that was broadcasting static. Everyone skipped right over it. Manx parked up front, nose into the side of the building, and it did not once occur to Wayne to try jumping or screaming or banging on the glass.
"Don't go anywhere," Manx said,
and winked at Wayne before he climbed out of the car and made his way inside. Wayne could see through the windscreen and into the diner, and he watched Manx weave through the crowd bunched around the front counter. The TVs above the bar showed cars zooming around a racetrack, then the president behind a podium waving his finger, then an icy blonde speaking into a microphone while she stood in front of a lake. Wayne frowned. The lake looked familiar. The picture cut, and suddenly Wayne was looking at the rental house on Winnipesaukee, cop cars parked along the road out front. There in the diner, Manx was watching the TV too, his head tilted back to see. The picture cut again, and Wayne saw his mother coming out of the carriage house on the Triumph. She wasn't wearing a helmet, and her hair whipped behind her, and she rode straight at the camera. The cameraman couldn't get out of the way in time. His mother sideswiped him as she sped past. The falling camera offered a whirling view of sky, grass, and gravel before hitting the ground. Charlie Manx walked briskly out of the diner, got behind the wheel, and Nosferatu glided back onto the road. His eyes were filmed over, and the corners of his mouth were pinched in a hard, disagreeable frown.
"I guess we're not going to have those sweet potato fries," Wayne said. But if Charlie Manx heard him, he gave no sign.
The House of Sleep. She did not feel hurt. She was not in pain. Pain would come later. Nor did it seem to her that she woke up, that there was ever a single moment of rising to awareness. Instead, the parts of her began, reluctantly, to fit themselves back together. It was long, slow work, as long and slow as fixing the Triumph had been. She remembered the Triumph before she even remembered her own name. Somewhere a phone rang. She heard it clearly, the brash, old-fashioned rattle of a hammer on a bell. Once, twice, three times, four. The sound called her back to the world, but was gone by the time she knew she was awake. The side of her face was wet and cool. Dick was on her stomach, on the floor, head turned to the side, cheek in a puddle. Her lips were dry and cracked, and she could not remember ever being so thirsty. She lapped at the water and tasted grit and cement, but the puddle was cool and good. She licked her lips to moisten them. There was a boot near her face. She could see the black rubber waffling on the sole and a dangling shoelace. She had been seeing this boot off and on for an hour now, registering it for a moment, then forgetting about it as soon as she closed her eyes again. Vic could not say where she was. She supposed she should get up and find out. She thought there was a good chance that the carefully fitted together fragments of herself would collapse once more into glittering powder when she tried, but she didn't see any way around it. She sensed that no one would be coming to check on her any time soon. She had been in an accident. On the motorcycle? No. She was in a basement. She could see the stained concrete walls, the surface flaking away to show stone behind. She could make out a faint basement odor as well, partly obscured by other smells, a strong reek of seared metal and a whiff of fecal matter, like an open latrine. She got her hands under her and pushed herself up to her knees. It didn't hurt as bad as she thought it would. She felt aches in her joints, in the small of her back, in her ass, but they were like the aches caused by flu, not like the aches of shattered bones. When she saw him, it came back to her, all of it, in a single piece. Her escape from Lake Winnipesaukee, the bridge, the ruined church, the man named Bing who had tried to gas her and rape her. The gas mask man was in two pieces, connected by a single fatty string of gut. The top half of him was out in the hall. His legs were just inside the door, his boots close to where Vic had been sprawled. The metal tank of sevoflurane had shattered, but he still held the pressure regulator that had been attached to the top, and some of the tank was attached to that, a helmet-shaped dome of twisted metal spikes. He was the thing that smelled like the ruptured septic tank, probably because his internal septic tank had in fact ruptured. She could smell his bowels. The room looked skewed, knocked crooked. Vic felt dizzy taking it all in, as if she had sat up too quickly. The bed had been flipped over so she could see the underside of it, the springs and legs. The sink had come away from the wall, hung at a 45-degree angle above the floor, supported only by a pair of pipes, which had come loose from their braces. Water bubbled from a cracked joint, pooling upon the floor. Vic thought if she had dozed a while longer, there was an excellent chance she could have drowned. It took some doing to get to her feet. Her left leg didn't want to unbend, and when it did, she felt a stab of pain intense enough to cause her to draw a sharp breath through clenched teeth. The kneecap was bruised in shades of green and blue. She didn't dare put too much weight on it, suspected it would fold under any real pressure. Vic took a last look around the room, a visitor to a grubby exhibit in some museum of suffering. No, nothing else to see here. Let's move along, folks. We have some fabulous pieces to examine in the next room. She stepped between the gas mask man's legs and then over him, being careful not to snag a foot on that low gut string tripwire. The sight of it was so unreal, she couldn't feel ill. Vic maneuvered around the top half of his body. She didn't want to look at his face, and kept her eyes averted while she moved past him. But before she had gone two steps back the way she'd come, she couldn't help herself and glanced over her shoulder. His head was turned to the side. The clear eye windows showed staring, shocked eyes. The respirator had been punched backward to fill his open mouth, a gag made of melted black plastic and charred fiber. She made her way down the hall. It was like crossing the deck of a boat beginning to capsize. She kept drifting to her right and putting a hand against the wall to steady herself. Only there was nothing wrong with the hallway. Vic herself was the boat in danger of rolling over, sinking back down into a churning darkness. She forgot to go easy once and let her weight settle on the left leg. The knee immediately folded, and she threw out an arm, grabbing for something to support her. Her hand closed on the bust of Jesus Christ, his face charred and bubbled on one side. The bust sat atop a bookshelf crammed with pornography. Jesus grinned at her lewdly, and when she drew her hand away, it was streaked with ash. God burned alive, only devils now. She would not forget about the left leg again. A thought occurred to her, random, not even entirely intelligible. Thank God it's a British bike. At the base of the stairs, her feet caught on a mound of garbage bags, a plastic-wrapped weight, and she tipped forward and fell into it for the second time. She'd landed on this same mass of garbage bags when the gas mask man had knocked her down the stairs. They had cushioned her fall and quite likely saved her from shattering her neck or skull. It was cold and heavy, but not entirely stiff. Vic knew what was under the plastic, knew by the sharp raised edge of hip and the flat plane of chest. She did not want to see or know, but her hands tore at the plastic anyhow. The corpse wore a glad bag shroud held tightly shut by duct tape. The smell that gushed out was not the odor of decay, but worse in some ways, the cloying fragrance of gingerbread. The man beneath was slim and had probably been handsome once. He hadn't decomposed so much as mummified, his skin shriveling and yellowing, the eyes sinking back into his sockets. His lips were parted as if he had died in the middle of uttering a cry, although that might have been an effect of his flesh tightening and drawing back from his teeth. Vic exhaled. It sounded curiously like a sob. She put her hand on the man's cold face. "I'm sorry," Vic said to the dead man. She couldn't fight it. Had to cry. She had never been what anyone would call a crying woman, but in some moments tears were the only reasonable response. To weep was a kind of luxury. The dead felt no loss, wept for no one and nothing. Vic stroked the man's cheek again and touched a thumb to his lips, and that was when she saw the sheet of paper, mashed up and shoved into his mouth. The dead man looked at her pleadingly. Vic said, "Okay, friend," and plucked the paper out of the dead man's mouth. She did it without any disgust. The dead man had faced a bad end here, had faced it alone, had been used and hurt and discarded. Whatever the dead man had wanted to say, Vic wanted to listen, even if she was too late for it to do any good. The note was written in smudged pencil with a shaky hand. The scrap of paper was a torn shred of Christmas wrapping. "My head is clear enough to write. Only time and days. The essentials. I am Nathan Demeter of Brandenburg, Kentucky. Was held by Bing Partridge. Works for a man named Manx. I have a daughter, Michelle, who is beautiful and kind. Thank God the car took me, not her. Make sure she reads the following. I love you, girl. He can't hurt me too bad, because when I close my eyes, I see you. It is all right to cry, but don't give up on laughter. Don't give up on happiness. You need both. I had both. Love you, kid. Your father." Vic read it while sitting against the dead man and was careful not to cry on it. After a time, she swiped at her face with the backs of her hands. She looked up the stairs. The thought of how she had come down them produced a brief but intense sensation of dizziness. It amazed her that she had gone down them and lived. She had come down a lot quicker than she was going to go up. The left knee was throbbing furiously now, stabs of white pain shooting from it in rhythm with her pulse. She thought she had all the time in the world to make it up the stairs, but halfway to the top the phone began to ring again. Vic hesitated, listening to the brash clang of hammer on bell. Then she began to hop, clutching the handrail and hardly touching her left foot to the floor. "I'm a little Dutch girl dressed in blue. Here are the things I like to do," sang a piping little girl voice in her mind, chanting a hopscotch song that Vic had not thought of in decades. She reached the top step and went through the door into blinding, overpowering sunlight. The world was so bright it made her woozy. The phone rang again, going off for the third or fourth time. Pretty soon whoever was calling would quit. Vic grabbed for the black phone hanging from the wall just to the right of the basement door. She held the door frame in her left hand, realized only absently that she was still holding the note from Nathan Demeter. She put the receiver to her ear.
"My Lord Bing," said Charlie Manx, "where have you been? I have been calling and calling. I was beginning to worry you had done something rash. It is not the end of the world, you know, that you are not coming with me. There may be another time, and meanwhile there are many things you can do for me. For starters, you can fill me in on the latest news about our good friend Miss McQueen. I heard a news report a while ago that she rode away from her little cottage in New Hampshire and vanished. Has there been any word of her since? What do you think she's been up to?"
Vic swallowed air, exhaled slowly. "Oh, she's been all kinds of busy," Vic said. "Most recently, she's been helping Bing redecorate his basement. I felt like it needed some color down there, so I painted the walls with the motherfucker." Manx was silent just long enough for Vic to wonder if he had hung up. She was about to say his name, find out if he was still there, when he spoke again.
"Good gravy," he said again. "Do you mean to tell me poor Bing is dead? I am sorry to hear it. We parted on unhappy terms. I feel bad about that now. He was, in many ways, a child. He did some awful things, I suppose, but you cannot blame him. He did not know any better."
"Shut up about him. You listen to me. I want my son back, and I'm coming to get him, Manx. I'm coming, and you don't want to be with him when I find him. Pull over. Wherever you are, pull over. Let my boy out at the side of the road, unhurt. Tell him to wait for me, and that Mom will be there before he knows it. Do that, and you don't have to worry about me looking for you. I'll let you slide. We'll call it even." She didn't know if she meant it, but it sounded good.
"How did you get to Bing Partridge's, Victoria? That is what I want to know. Was it like in Colorado that time? Did you go there on your bridge?"
"Is Wayne hurt? Is he all right? I want to talk to him. Put him on."
"People in hell want ice water. You answer my questions and we'll see if I answer yours. Tell me how you got to Bing's and I will see what I can do."
Vic trembled furiously, the beginnings of shock settling in. "You tell me first if he's alive. God help you if he isn't. If he isn't, Manx, if he isn't. What I did to Bing is nothing compared to what I'll do to you."
"He is well. He is a perfect little ray of sunshine. You get that, and that's all you get for now. Tell me how you arrived at Bing's. Was it on your motorbike? It was a bicycle in Colorado. But I suppose you have a new ride now. And did your new ride take you to your bridge? Answer me, and I'll let you speak to him."
She tried to decide what to say, but no lie would come to mind, and she wasn't sure it would change a damn thing if he knew. "Yeah, I crossed the bridge, and it took me here."
"So," Max said, "you've got yourself a mean set of wheels. You've got a bike with an extra gear, is that it? But it didn't take you to me. It took you to the House of Sleep. Now I think there is a reason for that. I've got a ride with a few extra gears in it myself, and I know something about how they work. These things do have their quirks."
He paused, then said,
"You told me to pull over and leave your son by the side of the road. You said you would be there before he knows it. The bridge can only take you to a fixed point, is that it? That would make sense. It's a bridge, after all. The two ends have to rest on something, even if it is just resting on two fixed ideas."
"My son," she said, "my son. I want to hear his voice. You promised."
"Fair is fair," Charlie Manx said. "Here he is, Vic. Here is the little man himself."
Shoot the Moon Fireworks, Illinois.
In the dusty bright of early afternoon, Mr. Manx swung the Wraith off the road and into the dooryard of a fireworks warehouse. The place advertised itself with a sign that showed an engorged and furious moon with a rocket jammed in one eye, bleeding fire. Wayne laughed just to see it, laughed and squeezed his moon ornament. The shop was a single long building with a wooden hitching post out front for horses. It came to Wayne then that they were back out west, where he had lived most of his life. Places up north had hitching posts out front sometimes, if they wanted to look rustic. But when you got out west, you sometimes saw piles of dry horse shit not far from posts like that. That was how you knew you were back in cowboy country. Although a lot of cowboys rode ATVs and listened to Eminem these days. "Are there horses in Christmasland?" Wayne asked.
"Reindeer," Manx said. "Tame white reindeer."
"You can ride them?"
"You can feed them right out of your hand."
"What do they eat?"
"Whatever you offer them. Hay, sugar, apples. They are not fussy eaters."
"And they're all white?"
"Yes. You do not see them very often because they are so hard to pick out against the snow. There is always snow in Christmasland."
"We could paint them," Wayne exclaimed, excited by the thought. "Then they would be easier to see." He had been having a lot of exciting thoughts lately.
"Yes," Manx said. "That sounds like fun."
"Paint them red. Red reindeer, as red as fire trucks."
"That would be festive."
Wayne smiled at the thought of it, of a tame reindeer patiently standing in place while he ran a paint roller over it, coloring him a bright candy apple red. He ran his tongue over his prickly new teeth, mulling the possibilities. He thought when he got to Christmasland, he would drill a hole in his old teeth, put a string through them, and wear them as a necklace. Manx leaned to the glove compartment and opened it and removed Wayne's phone. He had been using it off and on all morning. He was, Wayne knew, calling Bing Partridge and not getting an answer. Mr. Manx never left a message. Wayne looked out the window. A man was coming out of the fireworks place with a bag in one arm. He held the hand of a blonde-haired little girl skipping along beside him. It would be funny to paint a little girl bright red, to take her clothes off and hold her down and paint her wriggling, tight little body, to paint all of her. To paint her right, you would want to shave off all that hair of hers. Wayne wondered what a person could do with a bag full of blonde hair. There had to be something fun you could do with it.
"My Lord Bing," Mr. Manx said, "where have you been?"
Opening his door and climbing out of the car to stand in the lot. The girl and her father climbed into his pickup, and the truck backed out across the gravel. Wayne waved. The little girl saw him and waved back. Wow, she had great hair. You could make a rope 4 feet long out of all that smooth golden hair. You could make a silky golden noose and hang her with it. That was a wild idea. Wayne wondered if anyone had ever been hanged with their own hair. Manx was on the phone for a while in the parking lot. He paced, and his boots raised chalk clouds in the white dust. The lock popped up on the door behind the driver's seat. Manx opened it and leaned in.
"Wayne, do you remember yesterday I said if you were good, you could talk to your mother? I would hate for you to think Charlie Manx doesn't know how to keep his word. Here she is. She would like to hear how you are doing."
Wayne took the phone.
"Mom," he said. "Mom, it's me. How are you?"
There was hiss and crackle, and then he heard his mother's voice, choked with emotion.
"Wayne, I'm here. Can you hear me?"
"Wayne," she said again. "Wayne, are you okay?"
"Yeah," he said. "We stopped for fireworks. Mr. Manx is buying me some sparklers and maybe a bottle rocket. Are you all right? You sound like you're crying."
"I miss you. Mama needs you back, Wayne. I need you back, and I'm coming to get you."
"Oh, okay," he said. "I lost a tooth, a few teeth, actually. Mom, I love you. Everything is okay. I'm okay. We're having fun."
"Wayne, you're not okay.
He's doing something to you. He's getting in your head. You have to stop him. You have to fight him. He's not a good man."
Wayne felt a nervous flutter in his stomach. He moved his tongue over his new, bristling, hook-like teeth.
He's buying me fireworks, he said sullenly. He had been thinking about fireworks all morning, about punching holes in the night with rockets, setting the sky on fire. He wished it were possible to light clouds on fire. That would be a sight, burning rafts of clouds falling from the sky, gushing black smoke as they went down. He killed Hooper, Wayne, she said, and it was like being slapped in the face. Wayne flinched. Hooper died fighting for you. You have to fight. Hooper. It felt as if he had not thought of Hooper in years. He remembered him now, though, his great, sad, searching eyes staring out of his grizzled yeti face. Wayne remembered bad breath, warm, silky fur, stupid cheer, and how he had died. He had chomped the gas mask man in the ankle, and then Mr. Manx. Then Mr. Manx. Mom, he said suddenly, I think I'm sick, Mom. I think I'm all poisoned inside. Oh, baby, she said. She was crying again. Oh, baby, you hold on. Hold on to yourself. I am coming. Wayne's eyes stung, and for a moment the world blurred and doubled. It surprised him to feel close to tears. He did not really feel sad after all. It was more like the memory of sadness. Tell her something she can use, he thought. Then he thought it again, but slowly this time, and backward. Use something. Tell. I saw Grandma Lindy, he blurted suddenly. In a dream. She talked all scrambled up, but she was trying to say something about fighting him. Only it's hard. It's like trying to lift a boulder with a spoon. Whatever she said, just do it, his mother said. Try. Yeah, I will. Mom, something else, he said, his voice quickening with a sudden urgency. He's taking us to see... But Manx reached into the back of the car and snapped the phone out of Wayne's hand. His long, scrawny face was flushed, and Wayne thought there was a vexed look in his eyes, as if he had lost a hand of cards he'd expected to win.
Well, that is enough chit-chat, Mr. Manx said,
in a cheery voice that did not match the glare in his eyes, and he slammed the door in Wayne's face. As soon as the door was closed, it was as if an electrical current had been cut. Wayne slumped back into the leather cushions, feeling tired, his neck stiff and his temples throbbing. He was upset, he realized. His mother's voice, the sound of her crying, the memory of Hooper biting and dying, worried him and gave him a nervous tummy. I am poisoned, he thought. Poisoned am I. He touched his front pocket, feeling the lump made by all the teeth he had lost, and he thought of radiation poisoning. I am being irradiated, he thought next. Irradiated was a fun word, a word that brought to mind giant ants in black and white movies, the kinds of films he used to watch with his father. He wondered what would happen to ants in a microwave. He supposed they would just fry. It didn't seem likely they would grow. But you couldn't know without trying it. He stroked his little moon ornament, imagining ants popping like corn. There had been a vague notion in the back of his mind, something about trying to think in reverse, but he couldn't hold on to it. It wasn't fun. By the time Manx got back into the car, Wayne was smiling again. He wasn't sure how long it had been, but Manx had finished his phone call and gone in to shoot the moon fireworks. He had a slender brown paper bag, and poking out of the top of the bag was a long green tube in a single cellophane package. The labels on the side of the tube identified it as an avalanche of stars, the perfect ending to the perfect night. Manx looked over the front seat at Wayne, his eyes protruding a little from his head, his lips stretched in a disappointed grimace.
I have bought you sparklers and a rocket, Manx said. Whether we will use either of them is another question. I am sure you were about to tell your mother we are on our way to see Miss Maggie Lee. That would have been spoiling my fun. I am not sure why I should go out of my way to provide you with a good time when you seem set on denying me my small pleasures.
Wayne said, I have a terrible headache. Manx shook his head furiously and slammed the door and tore out of the dusty lot, throwing a cloud of brown smoke. He was in a sulk for 2 or 3 miles,
but not far from the Iowa border, a fat hedgehog tried to waddle across the road, and the wraith struck it with a loud thud. The sound was so noisy and unexpected that Wayne couldn't help himself and yelped with laughter. Manx looked back and gave him a warm, begrudging smile, then put on the radio, and the two of them sang along to "O Little Town of Bethlehem," and everything was better. The House of Sleep.
"Mom, something else. He's taking us to go see..."
Wayne said, but then there was a clatter, a thunk, and the loud thud of a slamming door.
"Well, that is enough chit-chat," Manx said, in his sunny carnival barker's voice. "The good little man has been through a lot lately. I wouldn't like him to become overwrought."
Vic wept. She put a fist against the kitchen counter and swayed, crying into the phone. The child she had heard on the other end of the line spoke in Wayne's voice, but was not Wayne. Not exactly. There had been a dreamy, spacey disconnect, not only from the situation, but from the serious, self-contained child he had always been. He had only finally sounded like himself at the very end, after she reminded him about Hooper. Then, for a moment, he seemed confused and afraid, but himself. He sounded drugged, too, like a person just resurfacing from deep anesthesia. The car was anesthetizing him in some way. Anesthetizing him while it drained him of his essential Wayne-ness, leaving behind only a happy, thoughtless thing. A vampire, she guessed, like Brad McCauley, the cold little boy who had tried to kill her at the cottage above Gunbarrel all those years ago. There was a line of reasoning there that she could not bear to follow, that she had to turn away from, or she might start to scream.
"Are you all right, Victoria? Shall I call back another time?"
"You're killing him," she said. "He's dying."
"He's never been more alive. He's a fine boy. We get along like Butch and Sundance. You can trust me to treat him well. You have my promise, in fact, that I will not hurt him. I have never hurt any child. Not that anyone would know it after all the lies you told about me. I have lived my entire life in the service of children, but you were happy to tell everyone what a great kitty fiddler I am. I would be within my rights, you know, to do terrible things to your son. I would only be living up to the tall tales you told about me. I hate to fall short of the myth, but I don't have it in me to be vicious to children."
He paused, then added,
"Adults, however, are a different story."
"Let him go. Please, let him go. This isn't about him. You know it isn't about him. You want to get even with me. I understand. Park somewhere. Just park and wait. I'll use my bridge. I'll find you. We can trade. You can let him out of the car. And I'll get in. And you can do whatever you like to me."
"You would have a lot of making up to do. You told the whole world that I sexually assaulted you. I feel bad that I stand accused of something I never had the pleasure to try."
"You want that? Would that make you happy?"
"If I raped you? Goodness, no. I am just being spleeny. I do not understand such depravity. I am aware that many women enjoy a brisk whack on the backside during the sexual act and to be called degrading names, but that is merely a bit of sport. To take a woman against her wishes? I don't think so. You may not believe it, but I have daughters of my own. I will tell you, though, sometimes I think that you and I got off on the wrong foot. I am sorry about that. We never had a chance to get to know each other. I bet you would have liked me if we had met under other circumstances."
"Holy shit," she said.
"It is not so unbelievable. I have been married twice and have rarely been without female companionship. Someone found something to like."
"What are you saying? You want a fucking date?"
He whistled. "Your mouth! You could make a stevedore blush, considering how your first date with Bing Partridge went. I suppose it would be better for my long-term health if we just settled for talking. Come to think of it, our first couple of encounters weren't terribly romantic. You wear a man down, Victoria."
He laughed again.
"You've cut me, lied about me, and sent me to jail. You're worse than my first wife. Still, you've got something that keeps a man coming back for more. You do keep a boy thinking."
I'll give you something to think about. Think about this. You can't drive forever. Sooner or later, you'll have to pull over. Sooner or later, you're going to stop somewhere to close your eyes for a while. And when you open them, I'll be there. Your friend Bing got off easy, Charlie. I am one mean, degenerate cunt, and I will fucking burn you to death in your car and take my son back.
I am sure you will try, Victoria, he said. But have you stopped to think what you will do if you finally catch up to us and he doesn't want to go with you?
The phone went dead.
After Mags hung up, Vic bent over, gasping, as if she had just finished a long and furious run. Her weeping was an angry thing, as physical and exhausting as vomiting. It was in her heart to take the receiver and begin smashing it into the wall, but a colder part of her stayed her hand. "If you're going to be mad," she heard her father say, "then use it, and don't be used by it." Had he ever actually said such a thing? She didn't know, only that she heard his voice in her head. When she was done crying, her eyes were sore and her face burned. She started to walk to the sink, felt something tug at her hand, and realized she was still holding the receiver, which was attached to the wall phone by a long black coiled line. Vic walked it back to its cradle, then stood looking at the rotary dial. She felt empty and sore, yet now that her crying jag was past, she also felt, for the first time in days, a kind of peace, much like the calm she felt when she was sketching one of her search engine illustrations. There were people to call. There were choices to make. In a search engine puzzle, there was always a lot of distracting visual information, a lot of noise. The first book had culminated inside an alien spaceship. Search engine had to find its way through a cross-section of the craft, flipping various self-destruct switches as he went and arriving finally at the escape pod. Between him and freedom, there were lasers, locked doors, radiation-filled compartments, and angry extraterrestrials that looked like big cubes of coconut jelly. Adults had a harder time with it than children did, and Vic had gradually realized that this was because grown-ups were always trying to see their way through to the end, and they couldn't do it because there was too much information. There was too much to look at, too much to think about. Children, though, didn't stand back from the puzzle and look at the whole thing. They pretended they were search engine, the hero of the story, down inside the puzzle itself, and they looked at only the little bit he could see, each step of the way. The difference between childhood and adulthood, Vic had come to believe, was the difference between imagination and resignation. You traded one for the other and lost your way. Vic saw already that she didn't really need to find Max at all. It was as hopeless as trying to hit one flying arrow with another. He thought she had let him think that she was going to try to use the bridge to catch up to him, but she didn't need to do that. She knew where he was going, where he had to go. She could head there any time she liked. But that was jumping ahead of herself. Christmasland was down the road a ways, both figuratively and actually. She had to be ready to fight when she saw Max again. She thought it would come to killing him, and she needed to know how to do it. More than that, there was the question of Wayne. She had to know if Wayne would still be himself by the time he got to Christmasland, if what was happening to him was reversible. Vic knew someone who could tell her about Wayne, and she knew someone else who could tell her how to fight. Someone who could even get her the weapons she'd need to threaten the only thing Manx obviously cared about. But both of those people were down the road, too. She would see each of them in turn, soon. First, though, there was a girl named Michelle Demeter, who had lost her father, and who needed to know what had happened to him. She had been wondering long enough. Vic cast a measuring glance at the angle of the light out the kitchen window, judged it to be late afternoon. The sky was a deep blue dome. The storm that had been rolling in when she'd arrived must have blown through. If anyone had heard the tank of sevoflurane exploding and tearing Bing Partridge in two, they had likely thought it just a roll of thunder. She supposed she'd been unconscious for 3, maybe 4 hours. She had a look at the stack of envelopes on the kitchen counter. The gas mask man's mail was addressed to Bing Partridge, 25 Block Lane, Sugar Creek, Pennsylvania, 16323. That was going to be a hard one to explain.
4 hours was not enough time to get to Pennsylvania from New Hampshire, not even with the hammer down all the way. Then it occurred to her she didn't need to explain it. Other people could worry about explanations. She dialed. She knew the number by heart. "Yes?" Lou said. She had not been sure that Lou would answer. She had expected